So please help me welcome our first speaker, Wade, from Utah.
I got a timer. Because all my friends know me. So, Wade Alcoholic. So where do I start? Born in Seoul, South Korea. Adopted by white Mormons in Utah. And that's it. I was one of the little kids that grew up at that the you know how when you played at the playground you play kissing tag, and my playground teacher would always call my parents. They say, "Well, the kids are playing kissing tag, and we have a little concern. Wade's not just trying to kiss the girls. He's trying to kiss some of the boys, and some of the parents have brought up some concerns." And so that's kind of where it first started. And growing up LDS, you learn a lot about the homosexuality and how that's not like one of the best things to be in the Mormon church. And quickly learn to be shameful and guilt-ridden from all of the things that they taught. And I remember when I first learned about the second coming of Jesus, that the world would go black and all the good people would be lifted up and the rest of us would stay down on the planet and burn. And I always had these nightmares that I was going to be lights. I was always in this dream running towards my family as they're getting lifted up, and I'm sitting there, "No, don't leave me, don't leave me." And the moon turning blood red and all that stuff. So a lot of shame and a lot of guilt built up in me as a little kid. And it was a very frightening time period from about 10 years old till about high school. I would have all these nightmares and feel like I was just going to be burning in the outer depths of hell. And it's funny because at 10 years old, I knew I was gay. A bunch of my friends, they had found some clippings of like Playboys. And we went into the garage, and they were all showing these little pictures, and they were all getting really excited about it. But I didn't look at the pictures as much. I was more like interested in what was happening with them than it was for me. So very early on, I remember my very earliest memories at 3 years old, and I remember having my pants past my underwear, and I had one of my mom's curl hair brushes, and I was brushing my hair and brushing my underwear at the same time. And I was looking at the door, and it was peeked open. My mom took a picture and put it in my baby book. And what she doesn't realize is, to me, that was kind of something naughty. And she put that in my baby book, and that's forever burned into my head. I went through high school. I had the girlfriends. I never did anything with them because, you know, I was a good Mormon kid, and I fell in love with this girl, and I thought I was going to marry her, but she didn't like Asians, so I learned very quickly. That's when I first learned what ugly was to me at that point in time, because we're all playing truth or dare. And I asked her at a seminary retreat, ironically, and and I said, "Why don't you like me the way I like you?" And she said to me, she goes, "Because I don't find Asians attractive." So at that moment is when I learned what ugly was in my mind. And so I spent a lot of time thinking I was very, very ugly. And and then dealing with being gay. And I went through high school. I fooled around with a few boys in the neighborhood. We'd play fake rape or fake prostitute getting arrested by the cop and stuff like that. And we did a lot of those things. But what happened as a result of that shame and that guilt is I came home early from my mission. I used to tell people it was because I was gay, dealing with the gay. But really, in all honesty, I missed my mom. And I didn't like being away from my mom, and so I came home early, and she wouldn't talk to me for 2 weeks. She wouldn't even look at me. So, that just added one layer after another, and eventually it got to the point where I was like, well, I'm already going to go to hell anyways. The Book of Mormon, church, everybody tells me I'm going to go to hell anyways. I got two choices. I can kill myself because that would be the best way to show them, or I could start doing all these other things that I see people talking about. It makes them feel good. And so I started smoking. Well, I'm going to hell anyways. Might as well have a drink. Going to hell anyways. Might do some drugs. Going to hell anyways. No, and I was a good Mormon kid. It wasn't until I was 21 that I French kissed my first person and had sex for the first time. And I used being gay for the catalyst for a lot of things. Why I drank, why everybody hated me, why I was different, why I was that, why I was this, why this happened to me. And as things progressed, what I found, I built this big shell up around myself to protect myself from you. And what I was learning this whole time in that time period of drinking and drugging and trying to fill that void is that my thing was, is I couldn't be okay with being gay until all of you were. And if there was one person that wasn't okay with me being gay, what would happen is then I couldn't be okay with being gay. And so up until I was probably a little older, I never dealt with that up until actually this last time through sobriety. I got sober the first time in 2001, and it was via rehab through the court system. They recommended that or jail, so I went to rehab, and I went to very expensive rehab. It's one of those $20,000 big books that people talk about. And you know, I didn't really work the steps. I didn't trust anything. And this whole time, I was in and out, in and out. I get a year and a half sober, go out for a year and a half, come back, get 9 months, go out for 9 months, come back, get 2.5 years, go out for 2.5 years. I kind of planned my sobriety and my relapses length of time were pretty equal to each other. And one of the things is I always did this. This is how I manipulated the program for me, where it talks about if you can go out and control your drinking for a year, that our hats are off to you. So what I would do is in my relapse, I would go out and drink like a gentleman for a year. Exactly a year till you would take your hat off to me and say, well, maybe you're not an alcoholic. No, thank you. And then I start drinking as heavily as I had wanted to, and I made up for that year. And that's how cunning and baffling that disease, this disease is for me. And all the time I kept thinking that the drinking and drugs were the problem, but what I really came down to for me is that I wasn't okay with Wade. I was never okay with Wade. And everything that I tried to do in my life was to shame away the gay, drink away the gay, drug away the gay. I you know, being Asian in Utah, also in San Diego, and just not feeling like I fit in anywhere. Everybody has their stereotypes of Asians and gay people, and I did everything in my power not to be that. I wore skater clothes. I was a raver. I did everything that I could possibly do to make myself appear straight. But when I talked, a purse would fall out of my mouth, so it was like it was over when I started talking to you. But, you know, so the reason why I want to spend more time talking about recovery is because most of us know how we got here. We all got here because of drinking and drugging, not feelings of low self-esteem, low self-worth. And what I like to share mostly today is the hope that I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and what AA has truly done for me as an individual. This last time through sobriety, it was down to the point where I had relapsed and come in. There, at the 2.5 year when I had had sponsees, I'd worked out 12 and I was doing the deal, but what I'd realized is I'd never let God in. And it really came down to that because I didn't believe that God could truly love a gay person. There's no way God could love a gay person because that's everything that I've been taught. And I did the whole, like, create your own God thing for a while. So it was like my biological mother that gave me up and she's dead in heaven and watching over me. It was karma. It was the ocean. It was everything that I could possibly try to create this that I could mold it around how I needed it to act for me. And when I finally came into the rooms, I was outside after my last run at work and I said, God, this is it. AA hasn't worked for me. AA hasn't worked for me. Prayer hasn't worked for me. Church hasn't worked for me. And drinking and drugging isn't working for me anymore. I don't know what else to do. And I go, if I don't have a solution, if I don't find a solution, I'm just going to end it because I'm lonely, I'm tired, and I already feel like I'm going to hell anyway. So what's the point? Why fight it anymore? And I had this this very overwhelming feeling of a very loud voice in my head says, go upstairs, get on the internet, and look up a meeting. And I went upstairs. I tried to go to the gay meetings in Salt Lake City, and very exclusive, not very inclusive group of people there. If you weren't the popular little gay wearing all the fancy clothes, you know, they just really weren't attaching to us. So I went up and I found this meeting called Candlelight. I remember walking in that room and I made a pact with God. I said, if nobody says hi to me in this meeting, I'm never coming back and I'm going to just go drink until I'm dead. And I sat behind this little post and I said, I sat there trying to hide behind this little post. This guy comes up to me and he goes, I don't recognize you. My name is so-and-so. What's your name? And that night, that man saved my life. And that's why I think it's very, very important when I go to a meeting that I extend my hand out to somebody that I don't know and say, hi, my name is so-and-so. I don't know who you are. What's your name? Because you never know if somebody else has made that pact with God too. I then started on a journey of really doing. I got to the point where it says in the big book, if you want what we have to offer and are willing to go any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And I was at that point. I was willing to go to any lengths. And I met up with John Ross and his brothers and that family, and they took me under their wings and invited me and welcomed me into that group, introduced me into some other things too as well, some other spiritual paths. And there was this experience that I got to have where we do this exercise where you reach into this treasure chest and pull out the one thing that you've always wanted in life. And before I was sitting there, I'm all, I want the car, I want the house, I want the great job, I want the good-looking boyfriend, I want to have all these things. And I reached in, I opened up the case, and I just remember with my eyes closed, it was bright. And I reached in and brought to my chest, and this overwhelming feeling came over me where I was flashed forward to standing before my Creator. And He says, welcome home, my good and faithful servant. And how dare you hate yourself when I created you in my image. And it was at that moment, because the only thing I've ever really wanted in my life was to know that God was okay with Wade and that He loved me. And I had that moment of clarity and that moment of complete... It's kind of like when you come home and your mom loves you and just says, welcome home, we've missed you so bad. It was that overwhelming feeling of just joy. And I remember going, opening up my eyes, I'm just bawling at that point in time. I said, I know what I have to do. I know what I have to do. And I got started on the steps. And I started getting active in the program. I had grown up in San Diego AA, and I noticed that Salt Lake City's YPAW committees had kind of fluttered away. They were pretty non-existent. And I knew how important YPAW was for me in San Diego. Even though I wasn't prepared to be sober because I couldn't get that relationship with God that I so desperately needed. And I started talking to a few people, and we started a YPAW. We started Salty Paw in Salt Lake City, and it's just grown into about a 30-plus people committee that, you know, obviously every committee has its struggles, as anybody will tell you, but the service work and the joy that comes into it, the hard work and the dedication from all the people that are on that committee that serves on that is amazing. And we do have growing pains, but it's been a true blessing. As a part of the our committee, I went to Mid-Year Summit for Wacky Paw. I was talking to a Wacky Paw advisor, and I said, you guys have all of these liaisons for Indians, Hispanics, and all of these other people. I go, why don't we have a gay and lesbian liaison? Why aren't we outreaching to the gay and lesbian community? And they are taking a motion now, and they're going to present that at Wacky Paw next year, and they're going to vote on whether or not to add a gay and lesbian liaison to Wacky Paw Advisory Committee. And if you're gay, questioning, wonder if God loves you and you don't know, you can borrow my God for a little bit because He loves me. And He's pretty fucking awesome. And I just encourage anybody, if you're gay and you don't know how to outreach, you know, come get my number after the meeting. I'd really like to put together like a phone list and a contact list, and maybe we can find ways that we can support each other in our individual YPAW communities and really set up that spirit of caring and unity that we so have been searching for in all of our sobriety, and kind of make this a place that's safe for us too. I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful to be able to serve on my committees and be able to be here and speak with, at the Ask of the Conference, because it's been a lot of fun. It's been a really big blessing, and with that, I'll take another 24.
Please welcome our second speaker, which is Lindsay from Arizona.
I'm Lindsay, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lindsay.
Wow, thank you for your share. I don't know how I'm going to follow that, but you know, I definitely related a lot. You know, I like that you talked about feeling like an other, right? And I could definitely relate to that. Not only being an alcoholic and that feeling of discomfort or feeling like I don't belong, which I started experiencing at a very young age, but also with, you know, being gay and coming out. I actually came out when I had, I think, maybe 60 days sober. So my sobriety date is July 23rd of 2003. That was not my first sobriety date. And I'll tell you, you know, aside from doing the 12 steps with a sponsor in the order, as they're outlined in the big book, and aside from maintaining service commitments and doing all those things, those musts, those suggestions that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think the difference for me, why I've been able to stay sober truly, is because I came out and because I got honest, and because of those words, to thy own self be true, really living in that and walking through that, you know, and just really getting close to a higher power, and kind of knocking down some of those walls that I had, because I also grew up in a religious household. You know, not Mormon, but my great-grandfather on one side was a minister, and my dad's side of the family is all Catholic. So I remember going to Mass with my dad, and my mom wouldn't go. Oh, so another thing, aside from being gay, and people tell me all the time, oh, you don't look like you're gay, and aside from being an alcoholic, which, you know, am I supposed to wear like a name tag or a pink triangle or something? Not really sure what that means. Aside from being an alcoholic, and today I like to think that I don't necessarily look like an alcoholic. To you guys, I might, but not to the normies, right? I'm also half black, right? And I get that all the time. Well, you don't look like you're half black. Your hair, I don't understand. How? Why does your hair look like that? I don't know. So. I didn't. It's not like, you know, you're born and you decide, hey, I want to have white hair. So I've always experienced that feeling of kind of being that other person in the room. So being the token gay, the token alcoholic, the token black, the token this, the token that. You know, I grew up in a household where my dad is Catholic, Republican, great guy. No, he really is. My dad's he's an awesome guy. I'm saying that because we have this connotation with political parties that means something. But, you know, and then I have my mom, who my parents actually met. My mom was working at a head shop. Right. Total Democratic voter. And now she's into like this whole political conspiracy theory thing. Like, she's so far left, it's not even funny. And after 21 years, they finally figured out that like that doesn't really work in a marriage. So they finally got a divorce. But, you know, I grew up in this household where there's like two sides to everything, right? There's like the Republican side. And I remember when we were, I think it was the, I can't remember which election. It was the one when Bush got elected the first time, George H.W. And I remember my dad telling me, well, if you want people to control your life and tell you what to do and spend all your money, then you should vote Democrat. Being very sarcastic, my mom's like, well, if you don't want to have rights as a woman and want to be a second-class citizen, then go ahead and vote Republican. So I've always had that kind of duality, I guess, conflicting sides, right? And both people I really respect and love. But, you know, I came in here the first time when I was 19 years old, and I was very confused. And I didn't start drinking like that. Some of the ages that some of you guys started drinking, not like 3 years old or anything like that, but I was definitely, you know, I'd been drinking for a while. I had my first drink when I was 11, and you know, I drank for the first time to get drunk. I can't say that at that time I was running away from anything, but I can tell you about my behaviors, and I was doing stuff before I ever picked up the first drink, like lighting green belts on fire and compulsively shoplifting. So there was a lot of unrest, and then I found alcohol. And through alcohol, I found the freedom to do the things that I was too afraid to do when I was sober. And I had my first drink at 11. By the time I'm 15, I'm blackout drinking. But I was always able to maintain that exterior, right? So I was a varsity athlete freshman year. I had a lot of friends, went to a lot of parties, got really good grades. I was told, you can do anything you want to do. All of that. I didn't experience any consequences. And I didn't know that I was gay. I just did not know. And people ask me that now. Well, how long have you been gay, or how long have you known that you're gay? And I'm like, honestly, I didn't know. I didn't know even when I got my first girlfriend when I was 17. I had no idea that meant that I was gay. I thought that just meant that we liked each other, right? Like, I didn't associate that with a label. And around that time, so I get this girlfriend, and there's all this turmoil, obviously, because she's straight. And any of you guys who have dated someone who's straight, you know what that can lead to. And it usually involves the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization of the gay person in the relationship. And that's what I went through. And that is how I hit my bottom, really. I was drinking. I'd been kicked out of ASU. I'm drinking, doing a bunch of other stuff, mainly because my life is just getting so out of control. I can no longer control my circumstances. I've been kicked out of my house. I've experienced a couple of things due to outside issues, like overdosing and things like that. Me and this girl, we had this off and on thing for a couple of years, and we were at a party at my friend's house, and I come out, and she's making out with this guy, right? So, like any normal, rational person, I took all of their shit, right? Like her purse, cell phones, the case of beer, his clothes, and just threw it into the pool. And this caused a melee where I got into my first fight with a guy. And I'd like to say that I held my own, you know. I landed at least one good punch, I know that. So needless to say, we broke up after that. And a couple months later, I end up no place to live, probably about 50 pounds less than I weigh now. I get a DUI in front of my parents' house at 8 a.m. That's a whole long story how that even happened, because I didn't live there. I end up in jail and in rehab. And the thing is, I had been drinking daily since I was a senior in high school. You know, I used to carry like a big thirst buster on the bus to school and drink, and like that's just how I dealt with things, right? Is putting alcohol into my body. And so I get into detox, which I don't really remember. Apparently, I was wrapped up in a white sheet for the 5 days that I was there. I go to rehab. And I start kind of realizing some things as I'm going through, you know, they take you through the steps in rehab, but kind of like not with a sponsor, you know, and I start writing out the sexual inventory. And I'm like, oh, okay. So when there's like more girls on there than there are guys, then that, okay, I understand. I started realizing that, you know what, I might not really like guys, you know? Now, I had a boyfriend. I mean, I always had boyfriends. I always had some guy that I was hanging out with, you know, but they never meant anything to me. And so I'm in rehab, and I start to figure it out, right? That, like, maybe I was in love with this girl. Maybe that's why it upset me so much. I remember that night that I was in rehab, and I realized it, and this just horrible dread, right, came over me. And I'm like, there's no way. I can't be gay. Not this. I mean, of all the things I've had to deal with, just not this. And I came into the rooms with a huge chip on my shoulder. And I tried to fake it from rehab. I went to a halfway house. I got a sponsor, but I just would not admit the fact that I'm gay. And really, nobody taught me that. You know, we were just talking on the ride down here that, you know, my parents gave me this sex talk, and they actually said, you know, some people, you know, like the same sex, and that's okay. Like, I was taught that that's okay from an early age. I was never made to feel ashamed or anything like that, except for that rhetoric that you hear in church. But, you know, my parents weren't like that. But, you know, I just had this dread and fear of really being myself is really what it was. I wanted to come in here and I wanted to put a mask on to everybody. I wanted to be who you thought I should be and who I thought that you were on the outside. And I drank. I could not stay sober. I mean, my 2 years in and out of these rooms, I was doing stuff like cutting myself in sobriety. I couldn't sleep. I was an insomniac. I was completely miserable. And finally, I went out on a year bender, and everything that I said that I wouldn't do or that hadn't happened to me yet, I got to experience that, and I finally came in humbled. And I remember when I started doing the steps, I did 1, 2, and 3 right off the bat. I got a sponsor. She took me through 1, 2, and 3, and we went up to the top of South Mountain in Phoenix, and we did the third step prayer. And I really felt it at that time. I'm like, okay, if I'm going to do this, I really have to turn myself over to God. And that night I made the decision that, you know what, if somebody asks me, I'm just going to tell them that I like girls. And, so I just started doing that, right? I just kind of stopped hiding. Nobody asked me, because you don't go around asking people, are you gay? The first person I came out to was my sponsor, and it was on my fourth step, right? Because we go through the sexual inventory, and she's like, okay, I see. And I'm like, yeah, so I'm gay, and she recommended that I tell my parents. I told my parents, and they didn't freak out. They weren't upset. They were like, okay, that's awesome. They kind of knew because, like, I'd been bringing girls home and stuff like that. You know, if you would have asked me 8 years ago what my life would look like today, I wouldn't have been able to dream of the things that I have, not material-wise, but the freedom that I have today, right? And really, truly, I believe this. Everything that I have today is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, is a result particularly of young people's Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why conferences like this are so important. This was one of the first things that I did when I got sober. I think this is my third ASCII PAW. I've been to 4 ICKY PAWs. I've been to 3 WACKY PAWs and ACKY PAW. And I don't know how I would have been able to stay sober without gay AA and without young people's AA. And I'm very lucky to live in a city where we're exposed to all of that. And I'm really honored that I had the opportunity to speak here and be the token female. As I told you, I'm used to it by now. I'm gonna shut up so we can hear from Kenny. So thank you.
Okay, so please welcome our third speaker, who is Kenny from Arizona.
I feel like there should be a microphone here. Let me pretend. My name is Ken Alcoholic Addict. I'd like to thank my opening up act. Thank you. No. Very beautiful. Very beautiful. Thank you guys for sharing. And thank you guys for asking me here. You know, it's funny because I got the opportunity to go and speak at conferences. And in the gay conferences, I always feel like, you know, you always have to qualify yourself, not as an alcoholic, but as you're gay enough to be speaking at that conference. And so I didn't know what I was going to be speaking or doing, but I was like, hey, can you speak? And I thought it was some little meeting that's going to be like, you know, like down the street from me. And he said, Casa Grande. I'm like, oh, shit. So let me get my car and head on over here and all that stuff. So, and it's funny because then I was like, okay. So then they get here and they're like, oh no, it's like a gay panel and being gay. And I'm like, all right. So then I have to qualify for 2 things again. So I keep thinking there's a microphone here. I love a microphone, but you know, I do. So you know, alcoholism and being gay. Okay, you know, obviously I knew I was gay. My mom knew I was gay. I think everybody knew I was gay when I was growing up. I would sit around and play with Wonder Woman, but we were poor, so it would be like ghetto woman. I had my sister's headband, and I had like an extension cord for a magic lasso, and I had gray tape, and I would run around my sister's underoos just spinning Wonder Woman and singing the song. That's all I did. That's how I played. Wonder Woman. And my mom's like, don't you want to be Wonder Man or Wonder Boy? And I was like, no. I'm Wonder Woman. How dare her? You know, I asked for Barbie. I got He-Man. Yeah. I always wanted an Easy Bake Oven. Oh, that was like every little gay boy's dream. And I never got it. That's why I'm an alcoholic, I guess. You know, I don't even remember, like, really around the age I had my first drinking and getting drunk. I know I was under 7. We were really fancy, and my aunt bought this box wine. It's great. And she got these little cups, and we poured them in, and the bottoms always fall off. And nobody liked it, and my sister went around and had me drinking them, and I loved it. And I got drunk that day, and everybody thought I was cute, and then I ended up throwing up and passing out, and that's where I started, and that's how it always ended. So nothing's changed in between. So I started drinking when I was little. I loved it. I tried to get alcohol any way I can. I started smoking when I was about 7 or 8. My mom smoked these Virginia Slims, really long cigarettes. They were fabulous. So I thought I was like one of those old starlet celebrities. I remember I would ride my bike and go play in the park and smoke cigarettes. And then, and then I probably had my first overdose 8th grade year. And I don't remember too much. It was also my only blackout. Went to a friend's house. They said, my dad makes moonshine. I love Dukes of Hazzard. So I was like, okay. So I drank some moonshine. And then we had this and that. And I said, okay. And that's all I remember. And I woke up a few days later. And I'm like all like weird, dizzy and stuff. And I was jumping in the shower. And I had all these heart monitors stuck to me. And my mom was home. And she was crying. And it's like, you died. I almost died. Or this or that. And the doctor said, you're going to be brain dead. And, you know, you should be dead. And all this scary stuff. And they said, you're probably not going to be normal. And they were so right on that one. But that started way before that. And so then she's like, wait till your father gets home. And so I love my dad. My dad did the best job he could. And I know today that my dad wanted me just to be better, you know. And so he was really strict with me. But being a little kid, you don't understand that. And so I feared my dad. And so when my dad got home, I got severely punished. And so what that taught me was not to drink, was that taught me not to get caught. And so I had my second overdose by I was like 16 or 17. And this time I decided it was safer to die than it would be to tell my parents or go to the hospital. But I had lived through that. And I just thought I was mixing the wrong drugs and alcohol together. So I figured if I just get the right cocktail, I wouldn't keep on overdosing. So by the third time I overdosed, I figured, you know, I just have to shut down a little bit on the acid and don't drink Boone's Farm and Cisco together. And, you know, I was always trying to get that perfect cocktail. So by the time I was 18, I was going to have a son. Well, I thought I was going to be a daughter, but ended up being a son. I got a girl pregnant. I know, I'm surprised. So, and here's the thing. Like, I remember there's a show, some of you might be way too young to remember, it's called Donahue. And Donahue had these super hot guys on the show. They were smoking hot, totally like with mullets and everything when it was cool. Furry chest, now I think it's disgusting. But so they were all talking, like, what are these guys? And all the audience are like, they're models, there's this. And it was like, they are gay porn stars. And everybody was like, you know, scandalous at the time. And this lady goes, you know, well, how do you know you're gay if you've never been with a woman? So I thought, there's my problem. I've never been with a woman. Never with a man either. But I figured I'd find that right woman, and then I would be straight. So I did back what the kids in the late 80s and 90s did. We found the biggest, heaviest girl, and we asked them to be our girlfriend because we knew they were going to be available. And we always have somebody to dance with. That's what we did back in the day. It wasn't as hip and cool today where all the cute little gay boys did all the cute little gay girls. No, it wasn't like that. And so that's probably why, because in my days, lesbians had mullets. And they wore plaid shirts. It doesn't really count now. Now lesbians are all hip and cool and hot. So we did that, and then I remember dating her, and then she starts telling her friends, I think Kenny's gay. And so I was like, oh, crap, I'm going to have sex with this woman. And I remember thinking that. So we did school, and I pretended I wasn't a virgin. I think she figured that out, like, way before the clothes came off, that I was. Like, 5 seconds into it, I'm like, I'm so gay. So I did what I knew how to do. I dated her for 4 years. And so obviously we had a son, which is one of the blessings that definitely came out of that relationship. I was so high one day, and I was trying to get my son a bottle. It wasn't that big a deal, but I poured the bottle. I couldn't even give him his bottle. And I remember freaking out. I had that little moment of clarity that says, I don't want to be a junkie anymore. Because by this time I was full blown. And so I did what all the boys did in my family. We joined the military, because that's going to keep me sober. All the boys in my family joined the military, but I have to say I was the only one that actually made it, so surprisingly. But that's because I had no self-esteem. I had none. I had little. I had zero. I had zip. I had no self-esteem because I, you know, Mormons were little. Catholics were really liberal. I was Southern, strict Southern Baptist, not the cool black Southern Baptist we can sing and be like, mm-hmm, yeah, girl, uh-huh. No, this was like conservative, don't talk, boring, brimstone and fire. They always said all the Catholics are going to hell because they're alcoholics, and I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and found I think they're pretty right. A lot of Catholics. The Mormons are going to hell because they're Satan worshipers. So we were really strict. And so I rebelled a little bit. I remember, like, in my car, because I was in the closet back in my day, you know, we couldn't come out in high school, listen to Madonna, like, you know, it was like the Like a Prayer album, you know, and stuff like that. Singing, like, Cherish and Like a Prayer. Da-da-da-da-da, you know, Express Yourself. And I'd pull into church. I'd take my Madonna CD out, or tape, actually tape, and put my Motley Crue Shout at the Devil tape, and, you know, go and be like, yeah, you know, like a little Antichrist type kid. And so I had no self-esteem, so I made it through the military, and, you know, the boot camp, they're like, you know, you're worthless. I'm like, I know. You're right. You're a piece of crap. Absolutely. So I made it through that, no problem. And then, but here's the thing. The military helped me get off of drugs, but my drinking career took off. The military loves, and they produce the best alcoholics because they love to get you drunk. I wish I could blame them, but... So I did that, so my drinking career took off, and then I married a different girl who was supposed to be a lesbian, and then obviously we get married, and then she wants to not be a lesbian. Ugh, I don't get that. I never get drunk and be like, oh, I'm going to be straight, you know. I remember, like, one time I have this moment of clarity that, like, you know, she thought I was an alcoholic, and she was drinking too, and she's yelling at me on the stairs, and she's like, I think you're an alcoholic. And I remember looking down and I go, I'm not an alcoholic because I don't piss on the couch, because she would always pee on the couch. And so I thought, that's what an alcoholic is, someone that pees on the couch. So I'm almost getting out of the military, and I go home on leave, and I had a friend of mine I used to use meth with, and I was going back on leave a little bit, and then he joined this occult called Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought it was kind of weird. So he takes me to this place, and they sit around a circle, and they chant, and then they talk about a higher power and spirituality, and then I was like, he's into witchcraft. All this stuff, and then so then I left back, and then one day I get a phone call, and his name is Billy, and I get a phone call, and he's apologizing for stuff, and I'm thinking, like, why are you apologizing? None of this really cares. Like, Kenny, I have to do it for me. And I didn't realize until later he was making an amends. He was doing a ninth step. And I remember telling him something I thought was interesting. I go, Billy, I don't know why you're doing this thing. I drink and drug way more than you, and I'm fine. He's like, I know you drink and drug more, but I have to do this for me. I didn't catch that till later. So I get out of the military, and I go visit him to surprise him. He's my best friend. I show up at the hospital. He had this thing called cystic fibrosis. It's a lung disease. And so I show up at the hospital, and I see his mom's crying, and she's screaming at me to go talk to this guy, Brendan. And the day I got back is the day he passed away. And so I never got to say, you know, I never got to really surprise him. He surprised me, I guess. A bitch. Always had the last one. No. And so... So I go talk to this guy, Brendan. Go talk to this guy, Brendan. And I didn't really, I'm not good with names, but I just remember there's this guy, Brendan, who was a lawyer and drove a BMW, so I remembered him. And he was at this occult meeting called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had two friends. I had one, my hag, that's what we called him back in the day, and it was a cool thing, it's not a horrible thing. And she needed to get off of crystal meth because if she didn't stop, then I was going to use. So if I wanted to stay off crystal meth, she needs to get off of it. And I had a really good friend needed to get to a meeting to sign a court card, and I figured I'd find a husband. So I go to this meeting to find some funeral information, and long story short, I didn't go there for me, but I stayed there for about 15 years, and I'm still an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to finish up in my, like, 3 minutes. At 15 years, I don't do anything different than I did before. I do everything today that I did my first year. I thank God for my sobriety at night. I ask God to keep me sober in the morning. I work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go to meetings, and I try to be of service. I was really young when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm very grateful for that. But sometimes being young is very difficult, especially today because of the scene, the parties, it's different. And I love when an old-timer told me that because it made me understand. He's like, Kenny, I don't wish to be young in sobriety like you, because at one moment you have the world at your fingertips. You have so many great opportunities that you can have because you're young and sober. But the other minute, it's going to be a lot harder, and it is a lot harder. So I have to stay in the middle of the boat. And I have gotten miracles in this program, and I'm going to hopefully shut up in 2 minutes. I know I always do this. But I want to talk about God for a second. Of course, I didn't think God loved me, so I had to pray for it, and I had to work the steps, and that's what the steps are for. I keep thinking there's a microphone here. I hated straight people because I was so angry that God has given to you so freely. You know, you can be a child molester, you can be a murderer, you can be a wife beater, but if you're straight, God will forgive you, and it's okay. But you can be the most honest, most noble, most kindest homosexual, but if you're gay, you're going to hell, and I hated that. I thought that was so unfair. And you know, and I believe my higher power talks to me, and he knows where to find me, at adult bookstore. So I was at this adult bookstore, and I found this pin that says, if God didn't want gay people, he wouldn't have made them. And that's all I needed. And I don't struggle with that in my sobriety at all, because the truth is, if God didn't love me, I wouldn't be here. But my God might not be a Christian God, because I don't have to have a Christian God. It might be. Who cares? But the thing is, I'm here. I know my higher power loves me. I don't doubt that one bit. And I learned that through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful to be here. And I love to share. I was going to say something wacky, Paul. Interesting that you said that, because I know the very first representative that they had in Wacky Paul, so they shouldn't have to vote on something that already exists. The reason why I know that, because the representative was me. I helped start Wacky Paul with Matt. It was a great honor that they asked. They wanted the gay and lesbian community to be a huge part of that. And so I remember sitting there at this little meeting. There was about 10 of us. You know, we went and talked to this thing called Wacky Paul, a branch off of Icky Paul. And we wanted to start it here, and then we're hoping, we prayed that it's going to grow. And they go, we want the gay community to be so involved in this. We want to welcome you. And so I was the first representative. I was the first liaison. I was the first. And I was also the first Miss Wacky Paul, because we had a contest. And I'll tell you a secret. Out of all the events that happened at Wacky Paul, they asked me to put on a drag show. It was the most popular event. We had more people go to that show than anything else. So when you go talk to your friend, you're more than welcome to give my number. They shouldn't have to vote on something that already exists. And that's sad. That makes me really sad that it lost its way. And it lost its way because we need to be more involved. Sometimes we have to go after it ourselves and not wait for them to come to us. It's a new generation. You're a new group of young people. There's so many more opportunities, especially in big cities. You know, I mean, don't go to, you know, Kansas or Oklahoma. You'll still get killed. But you know what? It's good. It's good that we can blend in. It's good that we're welcomed. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is one of those groups in the 1970s welcomed gay people. And that's why we have the third tradition. You should research it. It's a black, gay, tranny. God hit all corners. Racism, gay, everything. And heroin. Only requirement for A membership is a desire to stop drinking. That's what my sponsor said. It doesn't say to be an alcoholic. Only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. So if you have a desire, doesn't matter if you're gay or not, and you don't want to drink, doesn't matter how much drugs you do or what ism you have, you are welcomed in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, guys.
Okay, I've asked Adrian to read the third step promises. So would you please welcome her?
I'm Adrian. I'm an addict alcoholic. The third step promises, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed. If we kept close to him, performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or hereafter. We were reborn.